This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Rogue Cell, A Grower's War, Book 3. Written by DJ Mole, performed by Christian Rummel.
Prologue. They met behind a warehouse twice abandoned. It had first been abandoned when it was no longer useful to warehouse things, after which it saw a revival as a nightclub for a while. It was now abandoned for the second time because war had come to the city of Durham. When it had been in operation as a nightclub, it had been in the pocket of the resistance. It had been a safe place then, and it still was. It was night. A cool drizzle came down. The headlights of Jimmy's gray luxury sedan speared through them, illuminated all the little droplets that didn't quite fall like rain, but sort of drifted to the ground almost like snow. Across the cracked and pitted parking lot of the warehouse, another vehicle sat with its headlights on, and the glow from those lamps obscured the vehicle itself. Jimmy didn't prefer that, but that was simply his cautious nature. He didn't kid himself. There were enemies on all sides, and they weren't necessarily just the feds and the COAX. He himself had betrayed two men recently, Roy and Walter Balcom. And now Walter Balcom's wife, who was the Udy's daughter, was in charge of him, because he answered to the Udy's, and they had put her in charge. She claimed to be with the Udy's. Jimmy wasn't so sure. Wasn't so sure that she wouldn't hold a grudge against him. But who knew, right? She'd seemed like one hell of a cold bitch when she'd sent Roy packing back to the Udy's to an uncertain fate. Maybe she really was with the Udy's on this. Maybe she was just as crazy as her parents. "Here's good," Jimmy said. His driver stopped the sedan about 20 yards from where the other vehicle sat, waiting for them. He saw the ghost of doors opening behind those bright lights. A figure stepped out. Jimmy reached down into the floorboard between his legs and grabbed the cardboard box there. It was heavy. The contents clinked together quietly as they shifted. He opened his own door and stepped out. The light drizzle misted his face. The world smelled like wet concrete. The figure of the man he was supposed to meet walked around and stood between the two cars, now just a tall silhouette. Jimmy strode forward to meet him. The man had come out of the driver's seat. No one else exited the vehicle with him, and Jimmy didn't think he could see the shadow of anyone else. Jimmy was only tasked with dropping these damn things off, these things that were so important to the Udy's that they'd been willing to betray family to get them back. Simple drop, and then they were out of his hands, which Jimmy preferred. He walked up to the tall man. As he drew closer, the man's features materialized out of the gloom, and Jimmy recognized him. He was one of Honeycutt's men, a go-between sort of guy, trusted by Honeycutt himself.
"Carmichael?"
Jimmy greeted the man.
"Jimmy?"
He nodded back.
"That the infamous package?"
Jimmy lifted the box.
"It is."
He passed the box to Carmichael. The tall man opened one of the flaps and peeked in. He looked at the objects that it contained for a few seconds.
"Hmm," he stated. "They don't look like much."
Jimmy shrugged.
"Well, they're your problem now."
Carmichael shut the box.
"Indeed."
That was it. Nothing further to be said or done. Jimmy turned his back and started walking back to his sedan. He listened for the sound of Carmichael's footsteps walking back to his own vehicle, but the sound never came. Jimmy felt a slight offness, and he started to turn to look over his shoulder, but then he saw the windshield of his gray luxury sedan sprout a hole, and behind it, his driver's blood splattered the windshield. His brain only had time to realize what these visuals meant, and then a bullet passed through Jimmy's head and killed him. Carmichael sat back into the driver's seat. In the glow of the headlamps, he could see the mound of Jimmy's body lying face down on the concrete. His gray luxury sedan sat a few yards beyond him with a bullet hole in the windshield. The windshield wipers passed over it with a wet squeak. Carmichael closed his door, looked at the box in his lap.
"You got them?"
A voice came from the back seat. Carmichael nodded.
"Yep. Here."
He turned and passed the box back. In the gloom of the back seat, Stephanie Udy, known as Carolyn Balcom in other circles, leaned forward and accepted the box. She opened the lid and looked inside to check its contents, much like Carmichael had done. She also couldn't believe the amount of blood and betrayal, just for the four little objects it contained.
"It's a shame,"
she murmured.
"What's that?"
We're all supposed to be fighting the same fight.
Carmichael shrugged and faced forward again, put his hand on the shifter.
Are you?
In the rearview mirror, he watched Stephanie Udy look up at him with a frown.
Am I what?
Fighting the same fight. She watched Carmichael, and he felt that he was on thin ice. She didn't respond.
Are you fighting the coax? Carmichael pressed. Are you fighting your family?
Stephanie put the box in the seat next to her. She didn't take her eyes off of him.
They've always been the same thing to me.
Chapter 1. Every day had been the same, except for today. Today was different somehow. If Roy Balcom had possessed his brother's capabilities of reading people, he might have figured out why. But he didn't have those abilities, and by the time he figured it out, it was too late. Yesterday. Yesterday had been the same as the previous 2 weeks of Roy's pseudo-captivity. It had started the same, and it had ended the same, and everything in between had been close enough to the same that it made no difference. It started with a knock-knock, and it ended with a click-clack. Knock-knock woke him up, and then Price's friendly voice through the door. It's morning. That's what he said every time. Roy lay there in bed, looking at the door. It opened, as it always did. The knock and the announcement were all that preceded Price inviting himself in to speak face to face. Price opened the door halfway, leaned in, and shook his head.
Looks like you're with us again today. Sorry, man.
Roy got up, showered, shaved, dressed, went out of his room. There was no sunlight here. Perhaps that was why Price found it necessary to announce that it was morning. They were underground. Nothing so ominous as a bunker or anything like that. No, they were just in a basement. It was where they were quartered. The Udys had quarters secured for most of their people, sprinkled all over the country, but clustered in the southeast and lately clustered in Coax County, which was the dismal hell where Roy was currently located. They were flats that were rented. They were apartments that were owned by companies that didn't exist. They were spaces that had been straw leased under some random fake name. Some people had to fend for themselves when it came to their living arrangements. Many of the lower-tier grunts and boots on the ground, the muscle, the pushers, the listeners, the stalkers, the eavesdroppers, the informants, they all lived wherever they could afford to. According to Price and his partner Lenny, they were very lucky. Price and Lenny were babysitters. Well, they were more than that, but that was kind of their current assignment, and Roy didn't kid himself. Their job, among other things, was to babysit Roy. Because apparently the Udys did not want to kill Roy. They had not been very happy that he'd gone out in the middle of all the shit that was happening and tried to rescue his captured father. They'd been even less pleased that Roy had commandeered their secret weapon to help him do it. Jimmy, the man who had been supposed to help Roy, had ended up betraying him to the Udys. And then Carolyn, who appeared out of nowhere and was apparently now in charge, had sent his ass back to deal with the Udys' ire. But in all of that, they didn't want to kill him. They wanted him to prove his worth. So they stuck him with this little pair, and he ran around day in and day out doing errand boy busy work that mostly consisted of sitting in a car while Price and Lenny went into places and talked to people and sometimes collected things. There was a third party to this bandwagon of fraternity, but he hadn't shown up yet. He didn't live with them. He was the one that told them where to go and what to do. He was what you might call the liaison between the higher-ups and Price and Lenny, who were only a rank or two above foot soldier. The third guy was Nice, said Nice, like the city in France, and he usually showed up around 9 o'clock. That was when their day of business began. Nice would send Price, always Price, never Lenny, a message, and then they would immediately shove their breakfast dishes and coffee cups into the little kitchen sink, and they would exit their little basement apartment, which was actually a part of a warehouse, and then they would exit the warehouse. Outside the warehouse was the subterranean parking garage. Nice would be waiting in a vehicle. Most of the time it was a blue sedan. A few times it had been a gray GUV. It was obvious that Nice drove the car there, but when they emerged into the parking garage, he would be in the back seat. Roy would get in the back seat with Nice, who would smile and nod and continue drinking his coffee. He would often say something like, "Another day in paradise, huh?" Or if he felt particularly effervescent, "This fucking guy again. Ha ha, just kidding." Lenny would drive. Price would ride in the front passenger seat.
niece would tell them where to go, and that was pretty much it. Driving around, Price and Lenny getting out, going in somewhere, coming back out. Sometimes with something, sometimes not. Getting back in, niece telling them the next place to go. 12 fucking hours of this shit, broken only by lunch and dinner, which most of the time, they ate at the same fucking greasy spoon diner, which Roy didn't care for, but he highly doubted that his opinion bore any weight with the others. They talked, amongst themselves, but they didn't talk to Roy. It appeared that Roy was off limits, not in a good way, like he was being protected, in the bad way, like the quarantined way, like he was an infectious disease. Like if they spoke to him about anything meaningful, they would somehow be infected with the same malady, the symptoms of which were to have the Udies very pissed at you. So Roy stayed quiet, and he listened, and he stared out the windows at the grungy cityscape that was Coax County, and he occasionally tried to make himself useful, but the opportunities were few and far between, and he mostly seemed to make the others uncomfortable when he tried. He listened, and he made a game of learning everything he could about these three people. A list of stupid facts that made up their individualities. Lenny played the saxophone. Niece didn't play anything, and vocally disliked the performing arts. Price laughed easily and tried to agree with everybody. Niece had a cat. The others considered this unmanly, but didn't have the balls to say as much because they were lower on the totem pole. Lenny grew suspiciously silent whenever conflict was brewing. Price tended to run his mouth without thinking. Price also had a doctorate degree in marine biology. Lenny had virtually no education, but tried to sound otherwise. Niece had some education, but disdained it as an establishment of propaganda. Price always drank water. Niece always drank diet soda. Lenny drank about a gallon of hot coffee every day, regardless of how hot it was outside. The list went on, but you get the picture. Roy was bored out of his mind, and every day was the same. After dinner, they'd do a few more stops, usually for another hour or two. Then their shift was over, and sometime around 9 or 10, Niece would tell Lenny to take it back to the house. They'd go back to the parking garage. They'd get out. Niece would get into the driver's seat and drive away. They'd go into the warehouse, into the apartment. Roy would help clean up their dishes from earlier. Then he'd go to his room. Then Price would close the door, but before he did, he would always say, "Maybe tomorrow, man. Maybe tomorrow." Then he'd engage the lock. Click-clack. And it would be night. Roy was bored out of his mind, and every day was the same. It began the same, and it ended the same. Except for today. Today was different. It began the same as usual. Knock-knock. "It's morning." Price's head peeking in. "Sorry, man. You're with us again today." Shit, shower, shave. Breakfast, the text message, the clearing of the dishes, exiting the apartment. So far, everything blissfully, maddeningly the same. Roy floating along, dismal at another false horizon, a mountain that never seemed to reach its peak, no matter how much climbing Roy did. The blue sedan again, Niece sitting behind the driver's seat. Lenny got behind the wheel. Price and Roy went to the passenger's side. Roy got in, sitting next to Niece. Niece leaned against his door. His left elbow was propped on the handle, his left hand poised pensively on his lips, and a slight frown on his face. A small cup of coffee sat in his right hand, perched on his knee. Steam rose languidly from the drink-through hole. He looked out the window. Roy settled into his seat, eyeing the other man. He waited. There was nothing from him. Lenny adjusted his grip on the steering wheel. Price shifted in his seat, then looked back.
Good morning.
Niece looked up from his thoughts, and he glanced at Price with momentary confusion, like he didn't recall any of them getting in the car, or perhaps had forgotten who they were. Then his eyes averted. To hide the aversion, he flipped up his PD, cleared his throat.
"The asphalt yard," he said.
His voice was unusually soft this morning. Roy watched the man for a moment longer. Maybe he had a run-in with his old lady or something. Roy shrugged and looked out his own window. Price and Lenny exchanged a very quick glance. The mood in the car was still and tense, like Daddy was mad or something. Lenny drove them out of the parking garage. The day outside was overcast. You could see the Georgia humidity hanging in the air like fog. It veiled the far parts of the city, and long, straight roads terminated in indistinct haze. It was later than normal, too, almost 9:30. The streets were busy, but not packed like they usually were when they emerged from the parking garage at exactly 9:00. The bustle of setting up kiosks and opening storefronts was largely concluded. Now all the hawkers sat like spiders in webs waiting for prey. Roy watched it all pass him by. Honestly, he didn't care if Nice was in a bad mood today, or a sad mood, or depressed, or whatever the hell that he was. It wasn't like any of them actually conversed with Roy outside of quips and small utilitarian questions, so the car ride would remain much the same for Roy, albeit with less background noise. That was okay. Roy was feeling pretty irritable himself this morning. He knew that he was lucky to be alive. He knew that the Udies had every reason in the world to kill him. It was only their history together in that hellhole called DTI that had kept him alive. Some sense of loyalty that the Udies felt for him for everything he had done for them during their internment. But they needed to understand that Roy had no choice. Just like they felt they had no choice when they rescued Carolyn from District 89. It was family. Of course, Carolyn was on a capture list at the time. The COAX was going to use her against her parents, use her to draw them out into the open where they could be killed or captured. So there had been some strategy to it. But Roy knew as well as they did that it had also been personal. Maybe that was another reason why they had let him live. But despite the fact that he was happy to be alive, he was also kept in the dark. They hadn't told him anything. He gathered that something bad had happened for the Udies, which probably meant that their plan to kill Walter, Kaz, Javon, Getty, and Rat had failed. It also probably meant that somehow the echo device that the Udies had tried to keep secret had been used. But whether or not Roy's father had been rescued, or if any of his friends or his brother were still alive after that operation, he did not know. No one would tell him. Carolyn had implied that Walter might still be alive. She implied it by saying that she could do nothing to save him. Roy clenched his teeth together. That fucking bitch. He'd never known her. He knew that she'd cost good lives to pull out of District 89. Knew that she was the whole reason that Walter even got involved in all this bullshit. And so far, she seemed like she wasn't worth the effort. She seemed like a self-centered, backstabbing cunt. Heartless, Roy thought. Just like her parents. Carolyn, or Stephanie, he supposed, since that was the name her parents had given her at birth, and it certainly seemed that she identified with that lately, had somehow weaseled her way into being the point of contact for her parents' forces in Durham. And boy, oh boy, was that turning out to be a clusterfuck. He could only hope that she bungled the job and proved herself epically incompetent. The Udies were enamored with their dear little girl and believed her to be the rightful heir to their dynasty. Roy doubted that any failure on her part would result in the Udies blackballing her. However, it would be nice if the bloom fell off her rose. Roy shook his head at the window and let out a tiny, resentful snort that no one else heard. "I can do nothing for him," she'd said. He fantasized about an opportunity to hold her life in his hands so that he could tell her, "Sorry, I can do nothing for you." Unfortunately, opportunities for poetic justice rarely presented themselves. "Turn here," Nice said, his voice still uncharacteristically subdued. Lenny turned the car. The asphalt yard. It was out towards the southern edge of Coax County. Not so urban around here. Quieter. A good meeting spot. The asphalt yard had not been used in about a decade, and no one had refurbished it to be anything else. All the giant sifting and grading and mixing machines sat rusting. About $1 billion of infrastructure left fallow. "Around the back of that silo there," Nice instructed. Then he placed his coffee cup into the cup holder between him and Roy. His movements were very smooth, very deliberate. They drove around back. There was a black GUV waiting there. Roy squinted at it, feeling the oddness of the morning suddenly become ominous, like purple clouds rolling in out of nowhere when the rest of the sky is sunny. He sat up straighter. "The fuck are these guys?" Roy thought, looking at the black GUV. But he didn't ask the question aloud because he knew he wouldn't get an answer. Nice looked out his window again. "Pull up alongside them, Lenny," he said. "It's all clear. They're friends." Almost simultaneously, both Lenny and Price shifted in their seats, perhaps positioning themselves to be able to access the pistols they kept hidden in their waistbands, despite Nice telling them that they were among friends. Lenny pulled the blue sedan alongside the black GUV. The windows were tinted, too dark to see through. Roy got the impression of people inside, but couldn't see details. Businesslike, Nice held out a cupped hand, hovered it over Roy.
"Hold this, please," he said.
Roy, more on reflex than anything else, opened his hand. That was what you did when someone asked you to hold something. Nice dropped a little blue-black ball into Roy's open palm. Roy frowned at it.
"Is that a stun ball?"
Nice's answer came in the form of a current of electricity that crackled out of the little blue-black ball and sent Roy rocking back in his seat, rigid, teeth bared. But for some reason, he was still conscious. Perhaps because the ball was in his hands and not closer to the center mass of his body. Roy's eyes were open, and while the electric pulses were a horrible type of full-body non-pain that was both excruciating and dissociative, Roy was able to see everything that happened. Lenny and Price, looking in the back, at Roy, confused, fearful. Nice, putting a hand on Lenny's shoulder.
"Sorry, guys," he mumbled.
He had something in his hands, but Roy couldn't turn his head to see what it was.
Pop, pop!
Lenny's temple sprouted a red geyser. He looked surprised about it. Price's throat opened up like another mouth. He bared his teeth and looked angry, and he started to scrabble for his own gun.
Pop, pop, pop!
Price's chest twitched and jerked, and his shirt made weird little movements across his skin as the bullets passed through him and out the windshield. Lenny was already limp. Price followed quickly. Nice's door opened. He slid out.
What's happening? What's happening? What's happening?
A Mobius strip in Roy's mind. More opening and closing of doors. They were leaving him. How long was this stun ball going to go? The pain was terrible. The sound of an engine roaring, gravel skidding, pinging off the side of the blue sedan. Alone. Two dead bodies. Lenny stared at him. One eye looked like it was bulging. Roy was in hell. The pain had no end. And then it did. It went out like a candle in a wind. But his body was still inoperable. He heard people running. Someone yelling. His door was ripped open. He still couldn't move. Black cloth was placed over his head.
Oh, shit. Oh, shit.
He knew what this was. This had happened to him before. They dragged him out. Rough hands over his body. He sailed through the air, then hit the gravel hard. It ripped skin from his face. It knocked the wind out of his already shocked diaphragm. He couldn't breathe. Hands yanked behind his back. Something hard jabbing the back of his skull, and a voice in the deep timbre of a new breed.
You move and I fucking murder you. Not again.
Another engine. Another vehicle. Roaring up to them. Close. How long was the paralysis going to last? He wanted to run so bad, but his body was frozen. Useless. The hands lifted him up again. Carried him through the air. Then slammed him down on metal. Warm metal. The thrum of an engine. He was in a car, a truck, a van, something. Doors opening and closing again. Slamming. The vehicle rocking. Target secured, a new breed voice said. Move. And they moved. The engine revved, and Roy felt himself slide on the floor. Then he listed to the right as the vehicle took a hard left turn. The rumble grind of gravel turned to the smooth susurration of concrete.
Rather die than DTI. Oh my God, not again. Why did they do this? Why is this happening? I can't go back. I already made it out.
Roy could have wept in a panic. He felt fragmented. He tried to think clearly, but the paralysis and the sudden unexpected nature of everything caused his brain to spiral out of control.
Let me see him,
a new voice said. A normal man's voice. Something about it. Hands rolled Roy onto his side. The paralysis began to abate. He moved his foot. A gentle finger hooked itself under the black hood that masked Roy from the world. The black sack smelled of dirty laundry, of sweat and fear. But the hand that lifted it from him smelled like cologne, pleasant and businesslike. The black cloth was pulled from his face. Roy stared up. His eyes focused on the man that stared down at him. His eyes widened. The unspecified panic turned to very specific fear. "It's you," Roy tried to scream, but couldn't. No sound came out of his throat, and his mouth could not yet form words. It was the devil from his nightmares, from every hellish memory of DTI. The nicely dressed man smiled down at him.
"Roy Baucom, as I live and breathe,"
he said through a snake smile.
"I bet you never thought you'd see me again."
Paralysis fading fast now, Roy strained to get words out of his mouth. Anger words, fear words, all kinds of words. But they were still coming out garbled and nonsensical. All except one that came out in a strangled grunt.
"Goring."
Chapter 2. The bombs didn't stop. Jesus, it seemed like they went on forever. It became background noise, the constant screech of fast movers coming in low over the skyline of Durham, North Carolina, followed by the whoomp 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 of detonation somewhere out there, presumably in the red zone. Walter Baucom was shocked there was a skyline at all anymore. The air raids had been going on almost constantly for 2 weeks now. The coax had to have dropped thousands of bombs. You would think that Durham would be flat as a pancake by now, but it was all small munitions, smart bombs, laser-guided right up some insurgent's ass. He stood in hot morning sun, regretting his choice to don the light green jacket that he wore. Today was the first day of an apparent heat wave that would usher them straight on into summer. Of all the stupid places to stand, he was on a street corner. In Durham. Rubble at his feet, standing in line. For coffee. The place selling the coffee was a tiny little street kiosk in the middle of a section of the yellow zone that was half bombed and half intact. The last bombing here had happened towards the beginning of the conflict in Durham, and since then the few business owners that were ballsy enough to return to work had cleaned up a bit. But there was still evidence of war. Buildings with gaping holes in the sides where a mini-bomb had taken out a room. Walls with pockmarks stitched around and across them like a connect-the-dots puzzle hiding an inscrutable picture. The roads were still coated in a dust of finely pulverized concrete, and there was still chunks of debris scattered about, mostly clustered against light posts that no longer worked, or the overflowing trash cans that were no longer serviced, or the sides of bus stops that buses no longer came to. But life went on, apparently. Amazingly. Take this asshole at the kiosk, for instance. Knowing that on any given day he could get caught in the middle of a firefight, but he also knew that he could make a buck by selling shitty coffee to the other people that were out here trying to make a living. Life went on.
"I don't see him,"
a calm, quiet voice uttered in his ear. The bug tickled his ear canal. Walter had to resist the urge to reach in and scrape the damn thing out of there. And it wasn't just when he got a transmission on the thing. Turning his head a certain way would also cause it to shift in his ear like a fly was trying to get in. He could respond, but he didn't. He knew Bobby had his back. This was not their first rodeo. The last 2 weeks had been very busy for them.
"Yeah, I got nothing either," came Getty's measured voice.
Walter glanced down the street. About 2 blocks away, an electrician's van stood idling at the curb of a bombed-out building. A man in a traffic vest and a hard hat stood on the curb, surveying the damage to a crumpled transformer. That would be Getty. The line moved forward. The man in front of Walter, a middle-aged man that looked like he slept in his business clothes, and probably did nowadays, grabbed a stale bagel wrapped in plastic and paid it with a swipe of his PD. Then he turned and walked out into the yellow zone, holding his bagel like he wasn't really sure what to do with it. Walter stepped up to the counter. The owner of the kiosk was an older black man with very dark skin and nervous, suspicious eyes that darted around. The eyes lingered on Walter for a half second and then continued their impatient dance. Walter wasn't terribly worried about being recognized. The only published account of his face was the live feed he'd done that first fateful day in District 89, and that had been before his face had got half burned. He'd also been significantly better fed back then, and also a little more pleasant-looking in general. Now the left half of his face would not grow hair, and it had a weird, smooth texture to it. It was pale and unwrinkled. It wasn't mottled like scar tissue would be, but it didn't match the rest of his skin, and you could tell he'd been burned and that surgeons had applied neoskin to the wound. He wore a goatee now. He'd never cared for facial hair, particularly not a goatee. But it did its job. He didn't look much like his old self. His brown hair was also a bit shaggier than he usually kept it, and he was thinner now than he'd ever been, right on the cusp between wiry and gaunt.
"What can I get you?"
the man at the kiosk asked without looking at Walter.
"You roast your own beans?"
Walter asked. The man looked at him sharply. Walter held his gaze, sniffed, wished to tell the guy to hurry the fuck up. They didn't have all goddamn day.
"Just our specialty roast,"
the man at the counter said. Walter noted that there was no specialty roast. All the coffee came from the same brew machine. Without being asked, the kiosk owner poured Walter a large cup of black coffee, slapped a lid on it, wrapped a white napkin around it, and pushed it into Walter's hands like he couldn't get rid of it fast enough.
"That's $22.50,
he announced. Walter smiled. He couldn't blame the guy for trying to make a buck.
"Yeah, sorry. You'll have to put it on the company tab,"
Walter said with a chuckle. The guy shrugged, again no longer looking at Walter.
"Worth a shot," he said.
In his ear, Bobby's quiet voice.
"Fast movers incoming."
As she said it, Walter heard the distinct sound of air being split. It rose up so fast that there was never time to do much about it except cringe and plug your ears. Except Walter now held hot coffee, so he would just have to let his eardrums take the beating. The coffee seller uttered a single syllable.
"Shit!"
Walter just scrunched his shoulders up and shut his eyes and grit his teeth, the posture you might take before receiving a hard blow. The sonic boom rattled his bones, made his ears feel like they were popping.
"Motherfucker!"
the coffee guy shouted. Walter looked up, squinting through one eye. He let out a long breath. There was always the chance those bombs would drop on him. Whether accidental or because he'd been found out wouldn't matter much. Either way, his corporeal self would be scattered into particulate. But that hadn't happened. He was still among the living. Elsewhere, under the path of those fast movers, the sound of a few car alarms going off. Maybe a burglary alarm. Walter couldn't believe people still had those things active. They were being set off day and night, either by the fast movers or the following explosions. But, of course, there was also a lot of looting, so he supposed the alarm still served some sort of purpose. He started moving his feet again.
"You okay?"
Bobby asked him. He was. Felt dizzy in the head, but that was just the effect that the sonic boom had on him. It was like getting hit in the face. It made him loopy for a few seconds.
"Yeah, fine," he mumbled.
He got far enough away from the kiosk that he wouldn't be overheard, and then he opened the napkin that was wrapped around the coffee cup. On it were words, written in a bold, precise hand.
"Trinity and Magnum,"
Walter read aloud for the sake of Bobby and Getty.
"White stone building with red sign."
"The fuck?
What's wrong?"
Getty asked.
"That's right next to the green zone,"
Walter pointed out. Green zone, yellow zone, red zone. These were the terms that the coax had developed. The resistance used them for the sake of clarity, although they meant pretty much the opposite. Green zone was held and secured by the coax. It was the northeastern corner of the city. The yellow zone was a big swath that went through the center of the city and was not really a hot zone, but not really safe either. It was filled with people like the coffee guy and his customers. People just trying to keep living and hoping beyond hope that this bullshit would end soon. The red zone was resistance territory. There wasn't much of it, but the pockets of it that were there were in the western side of the city. The intersection of Trinity Avenue and Magnum Street was about a half mile from the green zone. Magnum Street was a long, straight street. You might be able to see the green zone checkpoints from the meat spot.
"I don't like that,"
Bobby murmured.
"Me neither,"
Walter said, but he was already walking in that direction.
"This is not what we agreed to." "It's your call to make, Walt,"
Getty pointed out. Walter kept walking in silence. His tongue found the spot on his upper molars that had chipped due to his incessant teeth grinding and worried at it there. He turned a corner, taking him north. He would tack his way over to the meat spot at Trinity and Magnum. He had about a mile to cover, so he had time to think, but not much. Not as much as he wanted. Then again, he never did. He sipped the coffee. It was actually pretty damn good. Too bad he was already sweating. He ditched the coffee cup and yet another overflowing trash can. It hit the pile of trash, caused a minor refuse avalanche, and spilled over the street. Walter didn't pay it much mind.
"Should I start heading in that direction?"
Bobby asked.
"If you want to go through with this, we need to start moving now."
Go ahead and start making your way out of that hide, Walter said. But give me a second to think this through. The sweat trickling down his back and sides was distracting. The jacket was too much for today, but he wasn't wearing his usual pistol, which was more readily concealable. Today, he decided to pack a chopped-down subgun under his jacket, which sat under his right armpit from a single-point sling. No buttstock and only 3 inches of barrel. But on the plus side, he did have 50 rounds. Why would he need 50 rounds? Well, just call it intuition. The meet was supposed to occur in the center of the city, which was squarely in the middle of the yellow zone. That was what had previously been agreed to. But Walt had not spoken to this individual in person. All their communication had been second and sometimes even third hand. This was the first time they were going to speak face to face. And normally, a change of plans would mean Walter would wash his hands of the whole damn thing and get gone. But there was a problem. And the problem kept Walter walking. You see, 2 weeks ago, after the raid that had freed Bobby and ultimately ended in the death of his father, Walter and Geddy and Bobby, the only survivors of the operation as far as Walt knew, had been absorbed by another resistance group. It was an arrangement of convenience. The leader of the group was a woman named Mel, a woman whom Walter had freed during the raid to rescue Bobby and his pops. The crew worked for her, and she worked for the Honeycutt organization, which meant that Walter had looked for the quickest way out of that relationship. After all, there was still a good possibility that Mr. Honeycutt himself wanted Walter dead for what had happened in District 89. It was a long, sordid story. Moving on, the opportunity to leave Mel's operation never came. The bombs started dropping, and Walter and Geddy and Bobby had nowhere else to go. So they fought with Mel's group now. And so far, if news had gotten back to Honeycutt that Mel's group had absorbed Walter Lawrence Baucom III, nothing had been done about it, because Walter was still alive and still going on missions. Back to the problem. 2 weeks ago, Mel's resistance group had included 40 fighters. In the bloody 14 days since, they were down to around 20. They would have been down even more, but a few other shards of resistance cells had been absorbed during that time, just enough to keep Mel's crew afloat. Along with the deaths came weapons and ammunition and ordnance that couldn't be recovered, not to mention dwindling, well, everything. You name it, they needed it. But what they really, really desperately needed, if they intended to continue holding the meager portions of Durham that they currently held, was firepower. Sure, big stuff would be nice, but that wasn't what they were in the market for. They needed plain old bullets. They needed spare magazines. They needed guns to shoot those bullets out of. They were about 2 good firefights away from going bullet bankrupt. Mel regularly sent requests up to the Honeycutt organization. They were regularly ignored. People began to wonder where the hell those renegade Fed troops had got off to and why the fuck they weren't helping the effort in Durham. What the hell was going on here? From everything anybody had been told, it seemed like the resistance had made Durham their main objective. But it sure as hell felt like they were being abandoned. Enter Martin Shreed, an arms dealer who claimed to be able to provide them with a massive quantity of stolen Russian battle rifles and enough ammunition to keep them shooting through the end of the year, or whenever the coax finally decided to level Durham. Walter had not met Martin Shreed. Without meeting or even hearing the man's voice, Walter could not employ his most useful talent, the ability to read people. Call it empathetics, call it body language reading, call it whatever you wanted. But Walter instinctively knew when he was being lied to. So far, his ability had not failed him once. But he couldn't use it until he met Martin Shreed. And so he walked toward a meet spot that was nowhere near where they'd originally intended to meet, and he walked because the prize at hand was too juicy to walk away from, which happened to be why it seemed so suspicious to Walter. Who the fuck was able to smuggle that much stolen hardware right into a war zone? No one, Walter thought. It was a pipe dream being sold to desperate people in order to lure them into a fucking trap. That was what one part of him thought. Then the other part of him would speak up and say, "He who dares wins." If they didn't have the balls to go out and make a few questionable connections, they couldn't expect to win this war. If they wanted to achieve the impossible task of kicking this coax out of their country, they were going to have to take some risks. And like any gamble, the bigger the risk, the bigger the reward. With all of this roiling thought, Walter hung on to a single thread of truth that went down straight to the core of him, like clinging to a rescue line in the middle of a raging river. The truth was that he was not a freedom fighter. The truth was that he was a husband. He was a husband that was going to do whatever he had to do to be with his wife again, even if that meant subverting the most powerful coalition of governments in the world. Carolyn was all that was left for him. She was his one and only true motivation. He hid her sometimes behind a curtain of patriotism, because that was easier to deal with emotionally than to acknowledge the cold, hard fact that what he asked of the universe was not likely to give. The days of being with Carolyn and living a simple life seemed to be in his past. His future appeared to hold only death and destruction. Walter realized that he was grinding his teeth again. The dull pain in his gums was like picking at a scab. It hurt, and yet somehow you wanted it to hurt. Focus on the task at hand.
Walt?
Bobby's voice was breathy after descending the building that had served as her overwatch point.
You want to call Mel and see what she thinks?
Walter recoiled from the idea. No, he said. Hell no. The last thing I want to do is have someone co-sign our decisions. We don't want someone that's not even on the ground with us to be calling the shots. All right, Walt, Getty broke in. You need to call a shot right now, then. Walter realized he'd already made his decision. He just didn't like it, and he waited and hoped that something, some factoid or circumstance would come to his brain that would make him feel marginally better about it all. But that probably wasn't going to happen. We're doing it, he said. Bobby, load up with Getty and y'all get on scene. You got time. It'll take me another 15 minutes to get to that intersection on foot. Yeah, Getty came back. We're on the way. Chapter 3. This is a mistake. But then again, he who dares wins. The mindlessness of walking helped soothe him, but not by much. He walked north now, along a street that had fared better than some of the other streets. North, on the right-hand sidewalk, so that the buildings he passed by provided him shade from the hot morning sun, which he appreciated. The streets were still dusty. Everything in Durham, regardless of where, seemed to be coated in that light layer of concrete dust. But at least there were no piles of rubble here. Walt saw only one building that looked like a rocket attack had taken off its top floor. There was no power on this block, though. So, though the buildings were still mostly intact, most of the businesses were closed because most businesses required power. There were a few that were making do with generators and solar panels. A flower shop, of all things, was one of them. A pretty older woman in a blue apron and gardening gloves watched Walter with hope in her eyes, like she thought that maybe this sweating, scar-faced man wearing the unseasonable jacket might be out on the streets looking for flowers. What use did he have for fucking flowers? What use did anyone have for them? A car passed to his left, which was unusual enough to cause him to look over his shoulder at it and stare at the occupants as they drove by. He found himself looking to see if they were looking at him, looking to see if they were wearing helmets or armor or if he could see weapons strapped to them. But it was just two men in business suits. They paid Walt no mind, continued up the street, made a right onto another street, disappeared. Not much traffic nowadays, either. An apartment complex, whole and untouched, sat to the left. It faced the rising sun, and apparently, without air conditioning, the morning sun was already making the apartments warm, because most of the tenants were on their balconies blinking gloomily at the sun as though it had woken them from a drunk sleep. Maybe it had. There was a mood to most people living in Durham these days. A sort of, well, we're here type of mood. Like they were just in the business of keeping up pretenses at this point. The power would come on, then it would go out. The water would flow, and then it would be shut off. The stores were open sometimes, but they closed early and weren't open at all on other days. Shipping companies were hesitant to send goods into a war zone. Understandably so. They were prime targets for the resistance. Walter glanced sidelong at those people in that apartment complex. He didn't like them. What the fuck were they doing with themselves? Maybe there was a fighter amongst them. Maybe one of them was the weekend warrior type, the type that had a rifle and some ammunition stowed under his bed, and he didn't come out of his apartment until it was night so he could harass some coax checkpoints and then blend back into the populace. Sure, that was a possibility, but Walter thought that most of those people were probably just people. Sheeple. Surviving. Hoping for the best, but not raising finger to do anything about it. Likely enough, their entire world was consumed with when they would be able to take their next shower, whether or not the grocery store would have milk back in stock, or when the power was going to come back on so they could watch that show they liked so much. These were Irby's, after all. Walter made a quiet grunt of disgust. "You say something?" Geddy asked. "No," Walt replied. "All right. Hey, we're pulling into place. What's your ETA?" Walter looked up the road. He was on Magnum Street now. 5 blocks away, he said. "Probably 5 minutes tops." "All right, slow your roll. Let Bobby get in place. She got a spot?" "Yeah." Walter slowed his pace. After a few minutes, Bobby spoke.
"Okay, Walt, I'm in position. I got a good view of the place that the instructions talked about. White brick, red sign out front. It's down an alleyway right off Magnum. To your right as you approach. No windows, though. If he asks you inside, I will not have eyes."
"Heard," Walt mumbled back. It went without saying that Walt was going to try to stay in the alleyway. But if he'd learned anything about these operations in the past 2 weeks, it was that you had to stay fluid. You just didn't know how things would go. And some of these people, shit, some of them were more paranoid than Walter. Paranoid to the point of mental instability. One time, Walter thought the guy was going to cut his head off. Literally. With the big-ass bowie knife that he had in his hand. Walter had almost reached up and rubbed his baby-smooth left cheek, the signal for Bobby to put one through the man's brain pan as he hovered over Walter, leering at him with suspicious eyes, and the bowie knife held back, but close enough to cut him with one quick movement. But things had worked out, and they'd been able to not only bring in about 700 gallons of gasoline, but they'd absorbed 3 decent fighters to boot. You see? He who dares wins. Walter trusted his gut. That was all he had anymore. His gut told him what to think. Perhaps on a subconscious level, it was the person's tone of voice and micro-movements that Walter picked up, but it came through to Walter as a very distinct physical feeling. Either the feeling that, hey, I can trust this guy, or something is very wrong here. One felt like light, airy relief. The other felt like a brick of bad news delivered to the stomach. Striding up Magnum Street, Walter saw the white brick building just a block ahead of him now. "Walking up now," he said. "Going off the air." Not really going off the air, just shutting his mouth. Bobby and Geddy understood this meant Walt would no longer speak to them directly. Down the street, off an alleyway, Walt knew that the electrician's van was idling, and Geddy was out dressed in a hard hat and reflective vest surveying the power lines. Somewhere on the roof of one of these buildings, Bobby had found a spot for herself and watched over him. As Walter approached the alley that Bobby had spoken about, she transmitted,
"Guy walking up fast behind you."
Walter's head jerked to look over his left shoulder. A guy in a thin jacket, ball cap pulled low, and sunglasses, his hands jammed in the pockets of his jacket, strode up abreast of Walter.
"Jesus, can you look more conspicuous?"
"Make a right," the man gruffed, though the pitch of his voice was high.
"Down this alley."
Walter faced ahead, then made the right into the alley. The white brick building was to his left. To his right was another brick building, this one gray. The alley was wide enough for a truck to be driven down, and at the rear of the alley was a receiving bay. The sliding doors were closed. No shipments to be received. The red sign hung above a single door, the only door in the alleyway besides the receiving bay doors at the end of the alley. The red sign had white lettering on it that said, "Simply Wine." Walter slowed to a stop at the door. The conspicuous-looking man shuffled around so that his back was to the door, and he faced Walter. The blank blackness of his shade stared buggily at Walter. Walter squinted back at it, not pleased.
"You Walt?" the man asked.
Walter nodded once.
"You Martin?"
The man glanced in both directions, then back to Walter.
"Yeah."
"This wasn't where we were supposed to meet."
"Well..."
Martin shuffled his feet.
"It is now."
"Why so close to the green zone?"
"Because this was the place I could store the shit," Martin snapped. "It's a lot of hardware we're talking about. I can't just park it wherever I fucking please, you know? I have security concerns to think about, too. It's not just you."
Walter looked up at the sign.
"Who owns this place?" "You don't need to know who owns it."
Walter looked back down to Martin. What did he feel right now? Not much. His gut rumbled around neutral, maybe a little keyed up. It was sometimes difficult to differentiate between his own nerves and the feeling of knowing something was wrong.
"Do me a favor," Walter said. Take those shades off.
Why?
I'm looking you in the eye. I want you to look me in the eye.
Martin smacked his lips, sucked his teeth, generally acted like a put-off teenager. But there was something to it that...
Fine.
He pulled his shades off. He had large, childish eyes. They glanced around with the instinctual paranoia of a young gazelle in cheetah country.
There. Happy?
Better, Walt said. Now what?
Now you watch and you wait. As much as possible in the time allotted, which was never much.
Did you bring the money?
Martin asked.
I have authorization on it,
Walter replied. 3.5 million proxied to the pirated personal device on Walter's arm.
All right, cool,
Martin said.
We got a deal then?
He thrust out his hand. Walter stared at the outstretched hand. Then he looked back up at Martin.
No, we don't have a fucking deal, you twat. I want to see the hardware first.
Martin's eyes blazed. He withdrew his hand. But he didn't respond to the insult. And that was the first thing that made Walter's gut twist.
Right. Yeah,
Martin said. He forced a smile.
Of course.
Martin then turned to the door of the building and knocked on it 3 times. Slow, evenly spaced knocks. The door opened. A man with a subgun strapped to his chest stepped out, eyeing Walter. Walter felt his body tense. What the fuck was this? Bobby's voice, calm and airy, in his ear.
I got the guy with the subgun. You let me know what you need.
By which she meant, give me the signal and I'll disintegrate his head. The man with the subgun didn't raise it. He stood off to the right side of the door, and Martin stood off to the left, holding the door open and gesturing inside.
Hardware's inside, if you want to take a look.
Walter became aware of his pulse pounding in his neck, his teeth grinding together.
No, he said, his voice steady despite what he felt. I'm not going inside the building with you.
Martin blinked a few times.
Well, then how do you expect to see the hardware?
Walter looked down the alley at the loading docks.
Bring them around to those loading docks. I'll inspect them there.
Martin considered this for a long moment. He flashed his eyes at the man with the subgun. Bang, bang, bang went the pulse in Walter's head.
No good. This is no good. Get out. But he who dares wins. None of this is worth your life. But if we don't win, you will never see Carolyn again.
Martin suddenly forced that same painted-on smile.
Sure, buddy,
he said. So accommodating. More accommodating than any other person that Walter had dealt with. Then he thrust his hand out again.
We'll bring him around for you. Deal?
Walter didn't even look at the outstretched hand this time. He just stared right into Martin Shreed's eyes and knew everything he needed to know.
No, Walter said. We're done here.
Walter wanted to run, but he didn't want to turn his back on the man with the subgun. Martin slowly retracted his hand. His eyes had gone to hard little nuggets of coal. A slight smirk at the corners of his mouth barely realized.
Money in the bank, Martin Shreed said. Money in the bank.
Fireworks in Walter's mind. That was a go signal if Walter had ever heard one. Walt reached up quick and swiped a hand across the left side of his face like he was brushing away a fly. Martin watched him do it, and it was very strange, because there was a moment of stillness just as Walter's fingertips touched his cheek, where he was locked in with Martin, both men looking at each other, and both of them knew exactly what the other one was doing, that the whole thing was a fucking farce, a trap, and Martin had just given a go signal, and so had Walter. Just a bare second of time, and it seemed like the thought that hung in the air between them was, sucks that it comes down to this. The top of the guard's head came off, leaving just his neck and his lower jaw, and the rest of it splattered across the whitewashed surface of the brick wall he stood in front of. The massive rifle report followed as the body dropped. Martin grunted and lurched for the open door under the red sign. Walter swept his jacket aside and brought up his own subgun in one smooth movement, even as the guard's headless body hit the ground and Walter fired from the hip, one long string of bullets that stitched up Martin Shreed's body from his ankles all the way to his ears. Then Walter turned without assessing whether Martin was dead, and he bolted for the mouth of the alley. Bobby's voice chattered rapid fire in his ear.
They're coming, they're coming. Getty, get Walt out of there.
And behind Walter as he ran, he heard the sound of the receiving bay doors rattling open, and all he could think was, rather die than DTI.
Chapter 4 Walter Lawrence Baucom pounded pavement, knowing that whether or not he lived through the next 10 seconds of his life had a lot to do with how fast he could move his legs. And for God's sake, it didn't feel very fast. The mouth of the alley still seemed like a long way off. He almost looked behind him to see exactly how many Coax soldiers were pursuing him, but knew it would only slow him down. He had to trust Bobby to do her job. And she did. Another booming rifle report. Walter heard a grunt from behind him.
4 new breeds on your tail,
Bobby said, speaking fast but level.
Make that 3.
A rattle of gunfire raked the alleyway behind him, and he watched the white brick to his right explode, and then a millisecond after that, someone punched him in the right shoulder and nearly sent him pitching face first into the concrete. He kept his feet somehow, came up twisted, saw back behind him. 3 new breeds about 10 yards back and gaining fast, one lying sprawled on his back further down the alley. They wore light armor, just helmets and chest plates, no spalders or greaves or battle shrouds. Walter yanked off a flurry of rounds, not sure if he hit anything and not caring. He was back forward, running as hard as he could. The alley opened up in front of him. Boom! Someone yelled, "Sniper! Sniper!" and someone else called, "Cover! Don't let them take you." Bobby had given him a narrow opening. He burst out of the alleyway while his pursuers dove into the cover of the door of Simply Wine. Walter jumped to the left, out of their line of fire, and staggered to a stop, subgun held in his right hand. His eyes shot up and down the street, scanning to the right and left. There, the electrician's van hauling ass towards him.
"Bobby, I'm clear! I'm clear!" Walter yelled. "Get the fuck out of the building!"
"I'm on the way."
She sounded out of breath.
"Be advised, they have gunships inbound."
"Of course they do." Walter ran for the van. It pulled up, its tires chirping and smoking. Walter hit the side of it and watched red splatter across the white paint. He realized it was blood from the bullet that had hit his shoulder. "Get in," Getty urged him. The cool-handed man stood on the brake with one foot, then kicked his door open with the other and stepped halfway out, dragging a rocket launcher out from the space between the 2 front seats. Walter threw the passenger door open and climbed in, taking a half-second to look down at his right shoulder where pain was starting to centralize. It got him right through the meat. His entire right arm was starting to tingle and stiffen. Walter grabbed the passenger door and slammed it closed.
"Let's fucking go!"
"Hold on." Getty shouldered the launcher and pointed it at the mouth of the alley. The 2 pursuing new breeds hit the mouth of that alley, just as the words left Getty's mouth. There was a distinct pop hiss, a sound that Walter knew well, and the back end of the launcher erupted in white, superheated gas, while a little green projectile slammed out of it, barely visible in the air for a split second before the entire mouth of the alley was engulfed in a violent explosion of dust. Rocks and debris scuttled over the surface of the van. A big chunk cracked the windshield. Getty threw himself back into the driver's seat and shoved the still-smoking launcher into Walter's hands. "That's how these streets get so damn dirty," he mumbled as he yanked the van back into gear and slammed on the gas.
"Bobby, we're on our way to you. This is gonna be hot extract, so be ready."
"I'm almost there,"
she said, her voice shaking as she ran. The van peeled away from the curb. Down the street, a lone pedestrian stood in the frozen stance of shock, not sure what to do, watching the pall of dust settle over the mouth of that alley. Getty cut a hard U-turn, slamming Walter into the door. He thought about doing something about his shoulder, but it would just have to wait. A little hole in the shoulder didn't matter much if a flight of gunships flame-broiled your whole body in the burning wreckage of a fake electrician's van.
"How many more rounds this thing got?"
Walter called out.
4,
Getty answered, taking a hard right turn. Walter waited for the van to straighten out, then thrust himself up through the already open passenger side window. A decorative lantern whooshed by his head, nearly knocking it off.
"Shit! Give me some room, Getty!"
Walter yelled. The van adjusted course, shifting to the left. Walter got his ass on the window opening, his whole upper torso hanging out. He hooked his left foot up under his seat and really hoped his leg muscles were strong enough to keep him from tumbling out. Then he dragged the launcher up onto his shoulder and started looking skyward.
"Hold on," Getty warned.
Walter held on for his life as Getty stomped on the brakes, cut another quick right, accelerated, and then braked again, this time coming to a screeching stop. They were beside a partially constructed tower. The construction was no longer ongoing. No sense building something that could get bombed at any time. Somewhere on one of those skeletal levels, Bobby had taken out 2 new breeds, but now she was at the bottom, a rifle on her shoulder, the rifle bag she carried it in trailing behind her. She hadn't had time to pack it away. She bolted out of the ground floor. She was a short woman, and the rifle she carried was nearly as tall as her. Her chin-length black hair was pasted back with sweat. She ripped the sliding door open and hauled herself in.
I'm good. Move.
The van rocketed forward again. Walter heard it, even over the roar of the engine.